We made this.
When I was a kid, I used to dream what it would be like to live somewhere far away from Hell's Kitchen. But I realized the city was a part of me. It was in my blood. And I would do anything to make it a better place.
Good and evil. Sometimes the difference between the two is a sharp line. Sometimes it's a blur. Sometimes we have to do things outside of the law.
We're gonna make a difference. I know it doesn't feel like it sometimes, but we are.
You're blind, but you see so much.
I hear things.
You know what they call stuff like that? Gifts. I'm gonna train you. Use it.
There are other ways to see.
Are left behind.
I don't see the city anymore.
Each breath you take is mine.
There's only dark corners.
I'll keep you safe, Karen. I have to be the man the city needs.
What are you gonna do?
Whatever it takes.
We fight every night for something. When the sun sets, we're both the same.
You and I have a lot in common. We're nothing alike.
Another man's evil does not make you good.
I respect your conviction. The lone man thinks he can make a difference.
This darkness is the light.
I'm just trying to make my city a better place.
And welcome back to Podcast 616, a podcast all about the Marvel Universe for the We Made This podcast network. I'm your host, Tony Black, and in this episode, our first episode of 2022, we're going to begin a season-by-season look at the Netflix-created set of Marvel series, beginning with the first season of Marvel's Daredevil. This season introduces us to Matt Murdock, Charlie Cox, a handsome small-time lawyer in New York's Hell's Kitchen who, aside from being blind, operates as a vigilante who police and the media come to know as the Man in the Mask. As he fights crime legally with his old friend and partner Foggy Nelson, played by Eldon Henson, and their assistant Karen Page, played by Deb Bramwell, Matt secretly battles his Catholic demons after the death of his pugilist father as a child, while working to uncover and destroy New York's most dangerous criminal, Wilson Fisk, aka the Kingpin, as his dual identity begins to destroy him from within. And joining me to discuss this season of television is my guest, the TARDIS Cruise, Baz Greenland. Baz, welcome back to Podcast 616 for a brand new year of Marvel.
It's good to be back, yeah. Looking forward to chatting Daredevil. I'm good to be back on Podcast 616 as well. I did a couple of episodes last year, so yeah. It's quite fun to be here.
Yeah, it definitely. It's nice to do this again with you as well. And I think we're in that middle phase right now between shows, obviously, as this goes out, which is very close to when we're recording. And we don't quite know what the next Marvel Cinematic Universe show is going to be. It's either going to be Moon Knight or She-Hulk, but we're waiting to hear. And we reckon that will probably come out in about a month's time. So because we had Daredevil, a.k.a. Matt Murdock, appear in Spider-Man No Way Home as his lawyer, which means he is now part of the MCU, or a version of him's part of the MCU. And we've seen Wilson Fisk pop up again, Vincent D'Onofrio in Hawkeye in the final episode, and his fate remains unknown. It seemed to make sense to go back to this Netflix universe and have a look at these seasons. And, you know, it could have been one of those things where we could have done each episode individually, but you're talking well over 100 episodes there, because they did a lot of seasons in that 3-4 year gap. actually, a lot of television. So it made sense to just go through one at a time, one season at a time, and they're always around 13 episodes, and unpick this. So this is going to be fun, I think, Baz. And it's not going to be you and I doing every single one, but it's going to be a nice recurring group of hosts as well. And I think it's going to be great to revisit all this again.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I watched them from the beginning. I haven't seen everything. In fact, I haven't seen all of Daredevil Season 3. It's on my list to watch, and I had, partway through it when you suggested doing this. I thought, no, I'm going to go back to the beginning and start with season one again.
Yeah.
And introduce my son, who is 16, so he's not too young because of the violence in Daredevil season one. It's definitely darker, but he obviously seen Spider-Man and Hawkeye with me, and he was like, well, we actually watched the first four episodes of Daredevil before Hawkeye, because he was like, oh, Kingpin's next week, and he had heard all the buzz about it. So let's see what the buzz is about. So he'd got to car smashing, head severing Kingpin, and then saw him in Hawkeye. So it's like, so he had a good introduction. So it was great to go back and revisit. So I love Daredevil, and I watched them from the beginning. I watched most of them. I've seen all but the second half of the final season of Daredevil. I've seen all of Jessica Jones, Defenders, Luke Cage, I've seen the first season and half the second, and Iron Fist I've never really bothered with. I've not heard good things about it, but it's I guess it's a thing. I think it was fantastic when it started, and by the end it was like, oh, I'll just kind of get to the end to finish it off. Particularly when they've been cancelled, like Jessica Jones came along, and I enjoyed the third season of Jessica Jones, and I was enjoying what I was watching on Daredevil as well, actually, and it felt like we were going up fairly strong, but at the same time it was like, it was hard to be invested when you knew that it was essentially being replaced by more MCU stuff and they've been cancelled. So, yeah, it's really exciting that, you know, the long-rumoured Daredevil and Fisk are actually in the MCU, played by the same actors, because they're both fantastic. And, yeah, it's really great to go back and revisit and just see how good this first season was.
Yeah. We'll come to that in a second, and we'll talk about general thoughts, really. But yeah, it's going to be interesting going back, because obviously now we've got the MCU TV shows. We've got a different register for how this is all being done. It's part of a broader universe. And, you know, we'll talk about this as well in a minute, but this obviously does tether into the MCU, sort of. But it did have license, this whole pocket universe, to go its own way. So stylistically and thematically, Daredevil Season 1 and subsequent shows are very different. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they weave these elements back in. I mean, there are rumours that we're going to see Kristen Ritter's Jessica Jones in She-Hulk, you know, so they are weaving these characters back in at various different points. So how they marry this up, I think, is going to be fascinating to see develop maybe over 2022 and 2023 and beyond. But it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun going through each season, looking at it critically. They're not all brilliant. They are very hit and miss. You won't be the only person never to have bothered with Iron Fist for various reasons. But I don't think any of them, and I don't think I've seen The Punisher Season 2 or Daredevil Season 3, actually. I think they're the only two I missed, because it kind of petered out towards the end, as you said. But I don't think any of them particularly are bad television. They are. There is some fantastic stuff. There is some stuff that's fairly average. There's some really good stuff, but I don't think anything really is bad particularly. Well, maybe parts of Daredevil Season 2 are, but that's a different conversation. We'll get there down the road. So let's focus and talk about Season 1 of Daredevil then, what we're here to do. And why don't we start, Baz, with a general sort of summation of what we think of this season as a whole, and what we'd give it roughly out of 10. So why don't you start first?
Obviously, an incredibly well put together first season. I don't think we can appreciate how good it was first time around, actually. And you know, I watched it over a couple of weeks, over Christmas, apart from a few days on Christmas, I didn't watch it, but you know, I watched it over like a 2 week period. And yeah, just the pacing and the storyline and the narrative structure is so well put together. And as an origin story, I think it's one of the strongest origin stories I've seen of a superhero character. You know, there are great ones there. There's Iron Man and Shang-Chi and few others as well, but I thought it was so well put together. And you know, when he got to the end and when he puts on the red suit, I felt earned. And I think it's really strong. I think some of the characters are really, really good. I think there's some really interesting mysteries there. I thought Wilson Fisk is phenomenal. And you know, it's easy to see why people were excited when he was rumoured to return. I mean, I did the podcast 616, the third episode, when he, the handshake, and he kind of first teased that he was going to return.
Yeah.
And I talked about it at the time with Matt, and it was exciting to see his return, and he's so good. And you go back and watch these, and you can absolutely see why. But Charlie Cox is great as Daredevil as well, and it's really, really good. I think very well paced. I think maybe in the latter half, the pace drags a little bit, but not compared to other Netflix shows that followed. And yeah, I think it's a really, really strong piece of television. It's dark and it's gritty and it's violent and it's not like anything we'd seen in the MCU outside of the Netflix shows, but I think it's a great piece of television.
What's your number then? What are you gonna score it?
I'm gonna give it a 9. I think it's a really, really solid. I think, having gone back and rewatched it, I don't think there's anything on the Netflix shows that I've seen that is as good as the first season of Daredevil. First season of Jessica Jones is fantastic as well. And there's some other good stuff as well. But yeah, I think this first season is the creme de la creme. They came out strong. I don't think it ever really beat Daredevil season one in terms of content.
The jury is out on that for me now, because I feel very similar. I was a huge fan of Jessica Jones season one. And that's obviously going to be the next one we do. So we'll wait and see how that holds up on a rewatch. I also was a big fan of Punisher season one, actually. I thought that was terrific. So we'll see. But I am inclined to agree. I think I'd give it 8.5 to 9. Maybe I'd go with a 9 as well. Because I do remember first time round being a little bit nonplussed with this. And feeling like it was a bit too long. It was a bit baggy at points for 13 episodes. Because, you know, now we've started to see television shrink. You know, we thought 13 wasn't a lot. You know, we grew up, didn't we, you and I, in the days of 24, 26 episode TV shows.
Well, I've still been watching Arrowverse shows when it's 23 episodes of Flash, and my God, that drags.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, exactly, right? And they're obviously network shows, so they have less money and they have more episodes, you know, by virtue. And that's the kind of world we grew up in, that you'd had shows that went on for 22 to 26 seasons, but they were quite cheap sometimes. You know, they had to. Whereas the money is pretty much on screen for Daredevil. There are only a couple of points where I thought in Daredevil that I mean, there was a, I think actually, funnily enough, the very final shot of the season where Daredevil is sort of on the roof and then he sort of jumps in the full costume, jumps into action. I did kind of think that looks a bit shit. Like nothing against the episode or the show. But, you know, I kept thinking of, like, The Dark Knight. I kept thinking of Batman, and you see these big shots, and this just can't compare to that. But then you have to forgive it, that, because of budget and stuff. So for the context of what it is, it's good. But, I thought 13 was too much, and now we're starting to see 6-episode seasons or 8-episode seasons. But I actually think on a rewatch, this absolutely was paced perfectly, really. Yeah. I can't really see any filler, actually, watching it again. And I think that having that space to really get into the characterization of these people, to really build up Matt's journey from beginning his career, essentially, at the very start of his career as a vigilante, to becoming Daredevil by the end of that episode, that final episode, and seeing Fisk go from being, you know, the guy at the top, essentially, the shady power broker, who they don't even say his name. He's that powerful. You know, we don't say his name, as Wesley says, to just being this quite, you know, broken figure at the end who's lost a lot of his empire, really. And I think it's great, you know, and you see that with all the characters. You see a real great art with Karen. You see a great art with Fogger. You see even some of the incidental characters, you know, they have good storylines. They have good arcs, you know, they pop up here and there. So I just was incredibly impressed by it when I was watching it. And like you, I sort of binged it in like a week or two period, and I watched one after the other, and I was pretty hooked. I was pretty addicted. And it's awful as it is to say, and I mean no disrespect to what we've had over the last year, but I don't think any of those Marvel shows in 2021 hold a candle to this, frankly, in terms of how good structurally, in terms of the writing, in terms of the performances, this is. I don't think they're anywhere near, actually.
I think you're right. I think, I mean, I really enjoyed Phase 4 in 2021 was a geek dream, and there was so much on there, and I enjoyed the ride. You know, I'm actually quite glad to have a little bit of a break and go, you know, let's have, I would be quite happy if they didn't release anything until March and just have a little time to digest and breathe a little bit. But yeah, there was a lot of great stuff there. I mean, Hawkeye was my favourite, which I guess is the closest in not necessarily in tone, but in terms of this, the kind of the street level tone of it was style of it, certainly was the closest. And that could have done with a couple of episodes, you know, the My episode, you know, Maya's history. If that had been like the Netflix show, you would have had a flashback episode with Maya, and like you did with Wilson Fisk in this season as well. And I almost felt like it was too much there. I mean, I thought Hawkeye was a blast. It was probably my favourite show ultimately in the end, you know, though WandaVision is pretty fantastic. I know you like Falcon and Winter Soldier, and that had some good stuff there as well. But I don't know. I kind of thought they breezed through the storylines. I don't think there was the depth that you get in a season like Daredevil season one.
No, and I think that's exactly why I have that feel right now that they're much quicker. They're like movies. They're essentially like movies that have been padded out to a little bit longer than a 2-hour running time, essentially. Whereas this is a series. This is a season of television. In that hybrid model, I think, between what we used to get in the old days, where you'd have good character work, but you'd have much more standalone storytelling. You'd have, you know, ongoing arcs that would, you know, something like, you know, we're big Star Trek fans, something like Star Trek Deep Space Nine, where things would, you know, go on for a couple of seasons and you'd have arcs that would be revisited. This is that hybrid model between that and then what we're seeing now with the MCU so far, which are quite short blast 6-8 episode, maybe 9 episode plot driven stories. And they are plot driven, whereas this is plot driven, but equally there are episodes that stand still. And maybe, for instance, like Nelson v. Murdoch, where a lot of it's just Foggy and Matt battling out about who they are, you know, arguing about the fact he's found out that he's the man in the mask. You wouldn't get that in the MCU shows right now.
No, you'd be lucky if you get a 10-minute scene with that, absolutely. I think if you look at Hawkeye, Falcon the Winter Soldier, Loki, arguably even WandaVision, you know, you can see a version of that as a movie. You can see a movie where you'll lose some stuff because it's 2.5 hours rather than 6 or 5 hours or whatever it is, but you can see them as movies. I couldn't see Daredevil season one as a movie. Daredevil is a TV series, and it affords that luxury to go into those characters, you know, to have the Fisk backstory episodes, to have, you know, like the second episode when you get Matt's introduction to Claire, and you know, the whole thing where, you know, and she becomes this kind of character cares for him over the course of the season. You know, there's not a lot happening there in a way in some of these episodes. Yeah, exactly. You said about Nelson versus Murdoch as well. You know, these are ones that will be afforded 10-minute scenes in a Disney Plus show, probably 5 in a film, but they're giving room to breathe, and I think that's what's really fantastic about it. And the character work is stunning. You know, particularly, you know, even things like Fisk and Vanessa. In the first time round, going in, I did not think my favourite thing about Daredevil season one will be the love story between Wells and Vanessa, and it still is. And I love it to pieces.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Mm.
It's not. I don't think it would be given the time if this was a movie. I think you'd be lost because the focus would naturally be on Matt Murdock and his team.
Yeah, completely. And that's the beauty of this style of show and the pacing that this gives. So I would happily go back to past Tony in 2015 and go, mate, you're wrong. Like, you're wrong about this. And in 6 years, you're going to wake up. But like, yeah, it's an excellent season. And I think we both had great fun, you know, watching it over again and binge watching it. And to be fair, this came out as a binge. All these seasons came out at once. You know, they didn't trickle out. And actually, I mean, I don't know what you think. I actually think this would have worked as a weekly release because quite a lot of the episodes end on good cliffhangers. They end on points where you go, oh my God, or like when Foggy finds out, for instance, you'd spend the whole next week on Twitter going, oh my God, what's going to happen? What's he going to do? He knows, you know, the expectation for that episode would be great. Or you know, they could have teased the end of episode 7 with Stick. And I don't think they do that. I think Stick just turns up at the start of episode 8. But you know, those are the things now that would just get Twitter alight, you know, and Instagram and all these things. So I think this could have rolled out as an episode, you know, but it came out as a binge. All these came out as seasons. So even then, we binged watched them. But it seems different now. I feel like with the distance of time and having seen some of these projects that have come since and some of the other things, because it's fair to remember. I mean, we should probably talk a little bit about the backstory of this a little bit, because How much do you know about the instigation for these series, Baz? Do you know much about how it all sort of came together?
Only high level. I do remember the announcement coming out. I used to be the TV editor for Cycle Digital Fix, and I remember the announcement coming out when these were announced. In fact, it might have been before my time actually, but I do remember the new announcement saying all your shows coming out and the excitement over it and Daredevil being given justice. You know, I remember at the time, and maybe naive me wasn't aware that we would get the quality of superhero TV films we've got now, but I enjoyed the Daredevil film when it came out of Ben Affleck at the time. You know, I thought it was fun, and you know, we're both Alias fans, and we do Authorised Podcast Only, and seeing Jennifer Garner in action is always great as well. And you know, I enjoyed it, and at the time, but I remember the hype and the excitement for these shows coming out. So you know, I've got a couple of friends who are massive comic geeks, and hearing about the likes of Jessica Jones and Iron Fist and Daredevil and so on coming out, and the Defenders, you know, it was exciting. But in terms of the development, I know that Drew Goddard was the original showrunner, and he dropped out because he was doing the Sinister Six, and look how that turned out. But I don't know much more beyond that.
You're kind of on the money. Just one point before this, the Daredevil, a couple of things. The Daredevil movie from 2003. Is very soon we're going to be covering that on Podcast 616 as part of Mark Adams's run of TAT, as he's calling it, the TAT Marvel movies, so the rubbish ones, the ones that people don't like. So we're going to do Daredevil 2003 and then Elektra, the Jennifer Garner spin-off film that came off that. It'll be interesting to go back and look at that Daredevil film again. I didn't think much of it, or Elektra really, and I still have problems with the whole, you know, Ben Affleck killed Alias thing, because that's a whole other conversation that we can have on Authorised Podcast Only, our Alias show. So yeah, keep an eye out for our coverage of Daredevil 2003. But yes, so after that film, because that film was made by 20th Century Fox. So as with a lot of these Marvel movies in the past, they didn't have the rights to the characters. And there are still certain films out there where they don't fully have the rights to some of the characters. Somewhat like Spider-Man is a good example. You know, you mentioned the Sinister Six. And Hulk, you know, Universal owns Hulk as well. So they can't quite make everything, but they're getting there. They're starting to hoover up these characters again, like the Fantastic Four recently. So we're going to start to see them eventually. So in 2012, the rights to Daredevil came back to Marvel Studios and to Kevin Feige, who said he wanted to bring Daredevil into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which obviously at that point we're talking, this is just after the Avengers essentially has come out. So Avengers Assemble. So it's kind of, the MCU has at that point made its first mark on the landscape. You know, it's had a few years trickling up, and suddenly the Avengers comes out and everyone goes, what is this? Like, this is taking over. And from then on, it's pretty much been dominant.
Yeah, it was exciting at the time, yeah.
Yeah, really exciting. I remember it well. So Marvel Studios essentially had that first dibs on the character. Drew Goddard goes in and pitches a Daredevil movie at that point, around that point. And he wanted to make an R-rated Daredevil movie. And Marvel and Kevin Feige turns around and says, we're not doing R-rated stuff. You know, we're not going back to the days of Blade 2 and you know, all that kind of stuff. Nothing wrong with Blade 2. I love Blade 2. I can't wait to cover the Blade films on this podcast, which we will do eventually, when we get Mahershala Ali's Blade and all that kind of stuff. But they were in a different era where Marvel movies were being made all in different points. So Goddard didn't want to do a watered-down version of Daredevil, essentially. He wanted to make it in the style of what a lot of the comics have done, and a lot of people who've taken it over since, you know, it was first created back in the 60s, have done. So he goes into them and he says, it doesn't have to cost $200 million. We need to do a story that is much more ground level. So he says, the thing about Matt Murdock is he's not saving the world. He's just keeping his corner clean. So it'd feel wrong to have spaceships crashing in the middle of the city. But because of that, Marvel, on the movie side, is not in the business of making 25 million movies, which he's imagining. They're going big, as they should. So he's saying that at that point, which makes complete sense, I think. You know, because, like I say, just had the Avengers, they're planning things like Guardians of the Galaxy. The MCU is doing the big populist stuff. So Daredevil in his little corner on a cinematic canvas isn't necessarily going to hit in the same way. So at that point, Marvel then decides that they're going to try and craft a TV universe around all of these characters. So that was roughly when the announcement comes out, around 2013, this is, about a year later, that they want to create, they want to centre it on these four characters, particularly Daredevil, Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, Luke Cage, and build up to the Defenders, which we get essentially halfway through this pocket universe, don't we? I think that comes after they've all had about a season, maybe.
I think Jessica and Daredevil had two, and the others had one. Yeah, so it was definitely well into the into this pocket universe.
Yeah. So they want us. They essentially say, let's repeat what we've done with the MCU, but on television. Let's have them all have an introduction, have a standalone introduction, essentially, with maybe the odd crossover, like they did with Iron Man and Captain America and Thor, etc., and have it TV-based and then build up to the TV version of the Avengers, which was the Defenders. And that was the one that really got me excited, Baz. I remember hearing that announcement. And I didn't have a lot of connection with any of these characters at that point because I wasn't a comics reader as a child, so I knew less than you, say, as a fan would have done. But I like the idea of a TV mini sort of empire of this building towards an event. That was exciting, wasn't it, when we heard the Defenders was going to happen in that way?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Avengers was so big, and you know, we knew it was going to be a TV version, but the idea of actually mimicking Phase 1 of the MCU, but on a TV level, was great, and particularly on with the Netflix announcement that came as well, because Netflix, when it started, was kind of only producing like high-tier TV. You know, it, obviously that changed as the scope became broader and broader, but you know, those apart from, you know, there was a couple of shows that were a bit naff, but generally the kind of content that Netflix was churning out was of a high caliber, you know, like the, obviously the early seasons of House of Cards, for example. And you know, so the idea of a MCU connected Netflix kind of pocket universe of shows was really, really exciting.
Yeah, yeah, it really was. And this sort of comes under the remit of Jeff Loeb, who's the head of Marvel Television. And he essentially, in this instance, becomes the Kevin Feige of this little pocket universe. Mm. And he reports to Feige, but he's kind of left on his own to do kind of what he wants to do within this remit, with the ability to go darker, with the ability to do things that they wouldn't do in the movies or do things. And before then, I mean, this is worth remembering, that Marvel had not really done a TV show in any kind of connected sense before. You know, the only one they had on TV in the MCU kind of sphere was Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which very quickly, and there's still debates about canon of that now, but it very quickly sort of spears off into its own thing when they struggle to sort of tether it to a lot of the movies, which they try and do at first.
Yeah, so, I mean, the first two seasons are much more closely aligned, particularly Winter Soldier, yeah, at the end of the first season. But yeah, yeah, you got a sense they moved on. You were thinking, it felt very disconnected. I mean, I'm a big fan of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. You know, I love the final season, yeah, for example, but the final season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has nothing to do with the MCU whatsoever.
Yeah, and in fact, I would suggest it probably contradicts a few things as well, actually, which is why I think the multiverse needs to help us out and explain that one, yeah, eventually.
I think that's it. It's a very, very close linked universe that almost, yeah, follows the Marvel universe up to a point and then diverges on its own.
And
so
then goes off. Yeah, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. season by season, I think, will be a future podcast 616 project. I think that'd be fun to do, definitely, and look at that show. But that's there. So this is different. This, they've never tried something like this before. They've never really tried to tether multiple shows together and go into a darker realm. So it's quite fresh and innovative. And in that sense, while Loeb is in charge of the whole thing and shepherding it, Goddard is hired as the showrunner of Daredevil, and he's happy with this, and he essentially gets to make what he wants to make. However, he only writes the first couple of episodes. He writes the first two, and then he steps aside when Sony hire him to make a Sinister Six movie, which is obviously, I mean, this is still something, Baz, that could well happen eventually.
And it's, well, particularly and if, now, yeah.
Yeah, if they get their way with what they're trying to do with Venom and Carnage, and they do all that, you might well see, especially after No Way Home, you might well see this start to happen. So but at that point, Goddard basically shot himself in the foot, really, because Sinister Six didn't happen in the end, after not everyone really loved Amazing Spider-Man 2. So he steps aside, and then it's Stephen S. DeKnight who takes over as showrunner at that point, and then shepherds the rest of the season. And I mean, personally, I think he does a great job. Drew Goddard obviously is a great writer. You know, he's from the Joss Whedon stable, essentially. He's heavily involved in Buffy and Angel. He writes and directs Cabin in the Woods, which is a great meta-textual movie around this point. And he's also involved in Alias as well, towards the end, at points as well. You know, he's a really good writer, and he knows exactly what he's doing. But equally, Stephen DeKnight has good chops for this. So I think between them,
DeKnight was also part of the Whedon universe. He wrote Essence of Angel, certainly.
Yes, of course he did.
And Dolan, of course he did.
But I think at this point, he'd mostly been involved in Spartacus, the sort of Spartacus spin-offs and things like that as well. But again, strong writer who'd been involved in the Whedon stable. Yeah, I forgot that actually. But then he did, after this, I think he did Pacific Rim 2 and things like that as well. But yeah, a strong pedigree. So I think it's a very interesting beginning point for Daredevil in how it sort of establishes itself as the lead show for this new whole universe. It's kind of carrying a lot, isn't it, Baz, really, as it goes into this? It's got a lot on its shoulders.
Yeah, I mean, I always viewed it, this was the Iron Man of the Netflix shows, really. It had two seasons before the big team-up miniseries. And yeah, he was the kind of the lead character. So, and I guess the one of all the characters as well who, because of the previous movie and because when you eventually get to it at the very end of the season, he's a more... slightly more traditional superhero than, say, Jessica Jones is. So I think, you know, if Daredevil hadn't worked, I think the others would have failed. Maybe Jessica Jones might have saved it a little bit, but Jessica Jones might have been the one of those. It might have been like the Wonder Woman of these shows, you know, where that was quite good, but everything else around it was pretty naff. So I think it had a lot riding on its shoulders. It had to succeed. It had to do well because this was doing a superhero at a TV level, which I think was starting to change as well. You talked about, yeah, Marvel shows. There hadn't really been much before. You know, obviously, you had Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and then Carter, the spin-off as well, around that well. You know, but really, Marvel TV content had been the X-Men and Spider-Man cartoons from the 90s, really.
Yeah, so it was, exactly.
Which I loved. I tried to watch some of them recently, and, you know, I think nostalgia is a great thing. But, I think... Yeah, getting this kind of grounded TV show up and running, was a big challenge, and I think they did it actually very well. It was around the same time that Arrow came out, which I'm a big fan of Arrow, the TV series.
Yeah,
and that
I was going to ask this actually. Yeah, I was going to ask if that was around the same time, wasn't it? Because I'm less familiar with the Arrow stuff. I've watched very very seldom really of that, but that was around the same time, wasn't it? That the DC were kicking all that off.
Yeah, in fact, looking at it, Arrow came out in 2012, so a year before this, and then Flash was a year after, which then led to Supergirl and Legends and all the others. So, yeah, it was really Arrow ran for two seasons on its own. So that was in its second season around the time that Daredevil came out, and that was, you know, I think those first two seasons of Arrow are probably some of the show's best as well. Before it got bigger, as much I love all the DC Arrowverse crossover episodes, but that's kind of another story altogether. But I think Arrow was proving that you could go from something like Smallville, which was like trying to be a superhero show but not have Superman in it, to actually doing a TV superhero show. And Arrow kind of in some ways beat Daredevil to it by doing something quite successful. I mean, it was a 22 episode season, it did drag at points, but there was some really great stuff there in bringing these characters together, and then starting later on to cross over characters. You get characters in the Flash now who'd regularly cross over as well. So Arrow had kind of shown a bit of that, but then Netflix did it with Daredevil, and Daredevil was doing very much the same thing. You know, if Arrow could kind of prove that it worked and was getting a good fan base, and then Daredevil came along and showed that actually you could do some really great superhero driven content on TV as well.
Exactly. It sort of builds off each other, doesn't it? Because in many ways, the Arrowverse probably would never have happened had the MCU not been as successful as it was. And they never would have really attempted this on a lower budget, on TV, on network, you know, television. So there's even less money than Netflix probably were able to give to Daredevil and these shows. And so, but equally, you wouldn't have had, like you said, the only real... Well, and this is why, actually, I feel like a bit sorry for it. Because Heroes... back in the mid-2000s, which very briefly was a massive sensation, a huge hit, very much sort of withered away and died on the vine, probably because of some duff creative choices. But I do feel that Heroes was maybe 5-6 years too early, and it just missed the point it should have been out, and I think it would have done much better and it would have been better received, because that was attempting to create a superhero show in a modern context, in a postmodern context at that time on network television, before the MCU really said, actually, we can do a shared universe. We can do a massive connected comic book style universe on screen and not just have it be random films, sequels, franchises in that way that we'd grown up, we'd been used to for 20 odd years, you know, by that point, 30 years even. And I think it's interesting how television never really got its head around this until this point, where you have the Arrowverse, you have the Netflix corner universe, and the MCU is obviously, you know, it might be the talk of the day right now, but it's coming very late. You know, it's coming nearly 10 years later to actually try and attempt this itself. So I think Daredevil in that sense, particularly his first season, has a big job in trying to convince people that, yes, you can tell a fairly conventional superhero story on television. Because it is, isn't it? It's essentially the origin. It's an origin story for a superhero who is understandably recognisable. He wears a costume. He's a vigilante. He's in a city. He fights crime. In fact, my wife said, when I was watching bits of it, and she watched it with me back in the day, but it had been a while since we'd seen it, she said, is he rich? Is he from money, Matt Murdock? I said, no, he's not from money. And she was like, oh, I seem to remember him being a bit like Bruce Wayne. And I said, but that's the thing. He is a little bit like Bruce Wayne. You know, he's handsome. He's got this dual identity. He's, you know, Matt, you could easily see Charlie Cox play Batman, Bruce Wayne, for instance, you know. Similar kind of archetype, except obviously he's blind, but he isn't from money. You know, his dad was a boxer, lived in a fairly, you know, working class sort of environment. But that's the iconography, and I understand why she said that, because that's the iconography of this kind of superhero, in that he's either got the Superman origin story where he's got a family and he's, you know, he's got this double life, you know, like Peter Parker, for instance, again, similar kind of thing, or he's this tortured rich guy who has this tragic backstory. So it's a little bit like Daredevil sort of sits in the middle of that, I think.
He does, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, the TV Bruce Wayne is at Oliver Queen in Arrow. So
exactly,
that's
really, yeah.
Storyline.
He's not as well known, I'd say.
He was, but anyway, he was kind of like second tier in the same way, I guess, that Iron Man was in the MCU. Yeah. So it's interesting the kind of the characters they play with. Daredevil is a weird one because he does sit in the middle. Flash is much more recognisable. And it's interesting they start with Arrow, not Flash, and kind of they weren't brave enough to go for a proper full-on superhero until a couple of seasons later. And then they went with Supergirl and then Legends, which is bonkers TV. And, you know, they've got Batwoman and Superman back as well and stuff. So there's loads of stuff out there. But, yeah, it was almost like they wanted to go with a grounded approach and a bit more realistic approach, maybe because it's cheaper, but maybe because it's almost like testing the waters. And I think Daredevil's an interesting one because, you know, he doesn't wear the costume until the final season. I was watching this with my son Ben, who I do the TARDIS crew with, and he's like, when's the costume? I was like,
yeah.
When's the costume? I'm like, I'm pretty certain it's episode 13. It's interesting that the last episode of season one is called Daredevil because, in fact, they don't even mention Daredevil, do they, until that kind of newspaper at the very end of the season. So it's basically pre-Daredevil. Daredevil doesn't start until season two, in a way, which isn't as good. So, yeah, it's interesting that it's almost like a precursor to Daredevil. Daredevil doesn't actually start until the final episode.
Yeah, which is, again, that kind of modern take on, in the old days, whenever you had a film like this, it started and he was Daredevil. You know, he had a career at that point. He was just the, you know, so it's a good take on that. You know, it's a way of building up to that understandable, recognisable superhero archetype that is there. And that's why I think it's clever that they started, like you said, with Daredevil, because he is better known probably than the other three, but equally he has the more recognisable story. He has the more recognisable dual identity concept that we understand, the general public understands superheroes to have, whereas Jessica Jones is a PI, you know, whose powers are vague, who doesn't have that superhero. You wouldn't think necessarily she was a superhero, you know?
No.
She would fit better as a character in the world of the X-Men with mutants, frankly, because she has more of that super strength kind of power that isn't quite, she's not one with gadgets, she doesn't wear a costume, all this kind of thing. So it's in a way, it's harder for traditional audiences to glom onto that kind of idea as a leading show. So I think they made the right choice with Daredevil leading the pack here and sort of being that bridge into a whole sub-universe. Because there is a tether to the MCU, isn't there? I mean, you see it more, I think, probably in the first episode. And because there's much more references to the Battle of New York.
That happens a lot, yeah. That's the main one. I think you never, the Avengers are never mentioned once. I think there's a reference to a man in a suit and a guy with a hammer at one point. And that's really it. You know, the Battle of New York, there's no mention of aliens. It's like there is a big incident that happened in New York previously and, you know, lives are destroyed and something big happened. But it could be so, but it could be a terrorist attack, you know, in the kind of context. It could be a 9/11 almost in the context of Daredevil. You know, you could almost imagine, you know, you could set it in 2002 and it would now almost fall in that way, you know, in the way that it's some big event that happened in the city that shook the city up. But it's enough of a terror, but they aren't almost, I don't know where it's a weird one, isn't it? Because are they not bold enough to kind of try and bring in a bit more on that? But at the same time, as soon as you start talking, oh, you saw it in the Eternals, you know, as soon as you start talking about, oh, what Captain America's doing or what Tony Stark is doing, then it kind of pulls you out of the story. So I think they probably did the right choice there. It's enough. And it's interesting as well, now having watched Hawkeye, and I know basically Matt Murdock's appearance is pretty much a cameo. It's a great cameo. It's a little cameo as a, yeah, and only a lawyer with strange powers, basically, is what it amounts to in Spider-Man No Way Home. But there's nothing so far that's contradicted by their appearances in those shows, really. I mean, I say you and I haven't watched the end of season 3 and maybe there's stuff there, but I think for the most part, you could imagine at the moment, I went into this watching it, as did Ben, going, yeah, this feels like it just a more conceptual precursor to those appearances in Hawkeye and Spider-Man.
But I think what's interesting when you look at these MCU shows now, and we'll be interested to see how Daredevil, Matt Murdock, etc. fits into this world, if that's what they're going to do. I mean, we could be over-egging this. They could just be simple cameos. They could just be little cameos and that'll be it. You know, that might be it. There might not be any other plans than that. There might not be plans to do a Daredevil season 4 or make him a main character in the Echo series and all these things that we're theorising about.
Yeah.
It might simply be a little nod and a wink, right? But what you're seeing in these MCU shows now is that they require, and they, even though Kevin Feige said, oh, you won't need to have watched the films to watch the TV shows or vice versa, it's like, well, you do. You do, come on,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You do, to really appreciate and enjoy them properly. So there is so much interconnectivity going on there that in a way, I think the shows are in danger possibly of suffering from that. In ultimately, whereas the beauty of something like Daredevil is it can mention the Battle of New York. And I thought exactly the same as you. I thought this is a massive sort of, because it's vague, it's a massive allusion to 9/11. This is, you know, you absolutely plays in that kind of field of a city that's been attacked is reeling. And then essentially what this show adds in that criminal context is that you get these corrupt forces rise up and take advantage of that vacuum of the fact you've had all this destruction. You get people like Fisk presenting himself as, you know, the industrialist savior of the city when in fact he's controlling all the crime in it, you know? So I think that's great. That's a great idea to play with. And if they'd have come out and said, and you know, like at the start of, you know, Hawkeye, you see him, you Kate seeing the Battle of New York through that prism and you see the Chitauri, you see all this stuff. If they'd done that in this and they'd explicitly said, oh, aliens came down and bombed the shit out of the city or whatever, oh, and Captain America was there and Thor, I think it might have devalued that ability of Daredevil to make that illusion, those illusions clearer and make it possibly a story about how a man has to fight against his own demons, against the law, essentially, and what the law expects in a world where corruption has consumed the law, essentially. And on the one hand, while he tries to fight crime and fight criminals legally, on the other, sometimes the only way you can get things done is to be a vigilante, is to be someone who strikes fear into the heart of the criminals in this city, which again is a very Batman idea. That's why he shares a lot of common ground with Batman. So I think I think having it not be too on the nose in terms of those MCU connections, quite apart from the fact it allows it to tell its own story, I think it actually helps the world building here. And I think it helps it be a much clearer vision of what the show is trying to achieve and what it's trying to say.
Yeah, I agree. I think that might change now, because now New York was getting very overpopulated. You've got Spider-Man, you've got Echo and so on as well. You know, I reckon if you're going to see them again, you know, it may, you know, maybe Daredevil is going to be the always team up Spider-Man with a superhero. And because they're going back to basics with Spider-Man, maybe it's Daredevil. That might make sense. Daredevil's the kind of the hero he interacts with in the next Spider-Man movie. I think that'd be fantastic. You know, give Daredevil his big screen presence, but not necessarily have to make... And also get away, you know, it's Spider-Man. You don't go, why is it not dark and gritty? Because actually he's in Spider-Man's movie. But that might work too. You know, I'm sure we're probably going to see Fisk again in Echo. You know, maybe Daredevil. But I say we're all surmising. But I think they're going to fit into other universes now. I don't think you can go back to their own corner now, because New York has Fisk. It has his Echo. It has Spider-Man. I'm pretty certain this is going to change. It's going to have Fantastic Four at some point soon as well. So it's going to get bigger and more populated. So I don't think they can necessarily exist in their bubble in the future. But what's great is that we've had these bubbles already that we've explored. And, you know, and I guess it'll be interesting to see how much they, if it's kind of almost a little bit of a homage, but it's his own story and the origins are quite different, or whether it's kind of done in a way, I suspect this might be for the most part, unless it becomes an issue for the narrative, that actually it's done with the assumption that these kind of happened, unless there's something particularly to tell in terms of the MCU, which is going to contradict with the show. So I reckon you're probably going to be able to watch Daredevil 1, 2 and 3 and for the most part go, yeah, this happened before Spider-Man Far From Home.
I mean, I would hope so. And because I think if you yes, okay, the multiverse can explain all kinds of things, but ultimately yeah, that explanation isn't going to work in the end. You know, there is only going to be so much they can get away with that before people start to say, well, hang on, that doesn't make sense. Because there are a lot of people who do value continuity, and we're starting to see that used to be a lot more set in stone back in the day. There used to be a very clear timeline of things in a lot of these kind of universes, or alternatively it would be this is the timeline, this is an alternate kind of non-canon thing, and they're two very separate things, whereas now it's all getting a little bit meshed together. And I think there are a lot of questions to be asked about what is the importance of something to be canonized. What is the importance of feeling like you're seeing a character evolve and develop? Is it enough to be able to see three seasons of Daredevil and see his origin story and then have it essentially contradicted by saying, oh, well, that maybe didn't happen in this kind of environment. And I'm not sure that's a good idea. I think they would be much wiser, even if this is tonally darker than anything else we might see Charlie Cox's Daredevil in the future. And
I think
almost
it will
certainly
be.
It will be. Yeah, I don't think for a minute... I don't think they'll make a Daredevil season 4, for one thing. And I don't think for a minute you will see Daredevil in the same way. Much like we saw Kingpin in Hawkeye, he was a different character in some ways. He was a yeah, much more over-the-top sort of Kingpin-y, rambunctious, boom, 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 kind of character. You know what I mean?
It was still him, but it was a little bit... The edge had been taken off a little bit at the same time. Yeah,
I mean, he was wearing a Hawaiian shirt, you know? Yeah. Like, Fisk in this season is just in black all the time. Yeah. Yes, okay, towards the end, the bear comes out a lot more because his back's against the wall and he has to fight to try and retain his power. So you see a lot more of the angry, you know, punchy guy. But for a lot of this season, it's D'Onofrio doing the thing he does so well, which is the tortured kind of... I mean, I love his delivery. Like, he is so good at that sort of wounded animal all the way through. But I just think that you won't see these characters in future shows in the same paradigm, in the same way. You won't see the portrayals quite the same if you were to see them again, I think.
Yeah, I agree, particularly Kingpin. I mean, you're never going to see someone have their head decapitated through a car door again. That's never going to happen. I can't see that happening in a Spider-Man movie, for example. Say Kingpin.
No, I'd be surprised.
Because Kingpin's a big Spider-Man villain, so it'd be fantastic to say the next Spider-Man movie, at a more street level, because it's going back to basics, actually Kingpin and Daredevil are in it. And I think that would work. I think that would be great to give them their big screen due while still kind of making it Spider-Man's movie. But you're never going to see those darker elements in there. You know, you won't see any blood at all, really, or anything. So it's going to be quite different. And I do almost, I don't know, worries are one word. It's three seasons of Daredevil, and I know I've seen enough of season 3 and I've seen season 2, so I know that season 1 isn't it for Kingpin. There's more to come in Kingpin as well. And I appreciate the performance. You know, obviously, I adore that performance. You know, he's basically a wounded animal. He's almost a child. He's a child in this beast of a body. And when he snaps, he's basically a child that has the strength to decapitate someone who can punch the living daylights out of someone. You know, it's kind of terrifying and almost heartbreaking at the same time when you look at it. And that's what's so great about the character. But I don't think you're going to get anything as nuanced as Kingpin again in the MCU. You know, I don't get wrong. I think MCU does some wonderful nuanced character drama. You know,
Some
stuff in WandaVision, for example. But I don't know if it's going to be at the depth you've got with this. And that's kind of fine, because I think he's still great. He was still great in Hawkeye. I really enjoyed him in Hawkeye.
Even though
it was a slightly light, more breezy version of him.
Time will tell, obviously. You know, we might well be proved wrong. But I think these... particularly, in fact, maybe this first season, and I haven't seen season 3, so you'd know a bit more than me, Baz, from having seen some of it. But season 2 even of Daredevil is different to this, partly because Denite leaves at the end of season 1 as well. So the two people who really instigated a lot of this creatively have gone, and then season 2 has a completely different set of showrunners. And you do see the show change a little bit. I personally think season 2, and we will come to that obviously in a couple of months, but season 2 does become, I think, a little bit more comic book and a little bit more overblown. And I think this season, and a little bit uneven, whereas this season has a really clear narrative through line all the way through and a really well thought out pacing and structure to it, to the point that you understand how we've got from A to B here with Daredevil, with Fisk, with Karen, with Foggy. And I think that is something that they didn't always manage to replicate. Even if we like this darker tone in this corner, this pocket universe, they weren't all as systematically good season by season as this season is, you know? And I think that's why in many ways this season is a not only the first one to really put this on the map, but it is one of the better ones because it does have a really well thought out strong structure to it.
Absolutely, yeah. You wouldn't know that the had been a change of showrunner, because it feels like everything is put together so perfectly in terms of the way it builds a story. And I do think there's a little bit of a kind of things slow down, but not to the point, not to the detriment of the show. Towards the end of the show before it picks up for a finale. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that's, again, exploring some of the character work, and particularly with Fisk as well. But it just feels like they've mapped out the entire 13 episodes, exactly what needs to happen, and then gone away and worked on the scripts and directed and produced the show. It doesn't feel like they've gone, okay, well, let's have the first three episodes, and then what's going to happen the next three, and we kind of know we want to get to here, you know. Example is the first scene of Picard that came out recently. You don't necessarily get a sense that those first three episodes of Picard are so well put together, and then it kind of just goes off this tangent and that tangent and this tangent, and doesn't go here and that doesn't make sense, and there's some great stuff in there throughout, and the end doesn't quite come together for me. And I think, and there's a lot of people, and I think it's because it didn't feel like they had mapped out 10 episodes. They kind of knew where the end was. They had a really strong plan for the beginning, and the rest of it didn't get there. You know, going back to Netflix shows, I think Jessica Jones season 1 has a sort of same thing, where it kind of feels really like they've got a full through line and where the story's going to go. And that's probably why it's really strong again, whereas later seasons don't necessarily have that. And, you know, Jessica Jones, I think, later on, meanders a little bit in the second and third seasons. I think, Daredevil season 2, you know, it almost feels like it changes direction a little bit, as does Luke Cage season 1. So it kind of... I don't think a change of direction is necessarily a bad thing. You know, Luke Cage season 1 feels almost like two seasons in one. But I think this is a season where it feels like there's a very clear through line throughout the entire season. And while some of the pacing and narrative might be a little bit slower at times, it's all there for a purpose.
I think, yeah. And I think they understand dramatically and tonally where they're going. I mean, Denite has said that he took inspiration, and you can see it in many ways, but he took inspiration from a lot of 70s crime films. The French Connection, Dog Day Afternoon, Taxi Driver. He said, we'd rather lean towards The Wire than what's considered a classic superhero television show. And, you know, arguably The Wire and those kind of shows have their roots in those 70s crime films and the kind of worlds that they would build. And I think you can really feel that they've got to grips with what they want the show to be in that vein. you know, and Jeff Loeb, who obviously had a lot of comic pedigree himself in Marvel, has talked about how he said that he saw the series approach to telling stories over multiple seasons to the world of publishing, where you have the Frank Miller, you have the Brian Bendis run, you have the Ed Brubaker run, but they feel different. They have different elements to them, same cast, in many cases, same tone, but a different adventure. And he sees that happening across all three of the Daredevil seasons. And this one, admittedly, I haven't read enough Daredevil to really judge necessarily what this season is playing off. But I would venture that the Michael Bendis stuff was a major inspiration. I've talked about this, I think, elsewhere, certainly on the We Made This Discord channel, but I think that is possibly the best run of comics I have ever read in my life. Because it's around the 2005, roughly, I think it sort of starts. But it's a fantastic run of Daredevil over multiple years. And it covers all kinds of things. It covers Fisk. It covers Fisk essentially as a Godfather-esque figure. I mean, it's so Godfather, you know. And in terms of the long form storytelling it tells with corruption in the city and how Daredevil has to fight against Fisk and lots of other crime figures like the Owl and various people who haven't been seen in this show. And then there's some incredible stuff with Echo, which I hope that they bring into the TV show eventually, because I'd love to see it happen. So there's all kinds of fantastic stuff in that run. And I think that's the key, in that they understood the inspirations, they understood the source material, they understood what they wanted to get to with this season, which was ultimately the origin story of Matt, telling the backstory about his relationship with his father, you know, which is so key to his Catholic guilt that he's so powerful throughout this series, which you see in his confessions with the vicar, and ultimately taking Fisk down while bringing together this team of Karen and Foggy. So there's a lot of constituent elements, I think, in the pot, but they seem to understand where they want to get to by the end of the season with them. And you don't get that in a lot of television series where they've really, like you said, worked it out really well.
Yeah, I would argue Fisk's origin here, because...
Oh, yeah, you know, definitely.
You get the whole sense, you know, particularly when you get to his flashback episode where he's childhood as well, you get the idea of why he is who he is, you know, the fact, and you get, essentially, it's almost like the rise and fall of Fisk in the first season, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the downfall, you know, it's kind of Vanessa, but that's such a beautiful storyline as well, which is amazing to watch. And, I think Fisk is as well-rounded in terms of his character... I'd say as much as Matt is over the course of the first season, as is, you know, Foggy. You get a lot with where he's coming from, and Karen particularly as well. You know, they are a really strong team, the three of them, and you know, there's some great, absolutely fantastic work done with the core cast in this show.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that actually. That in terms of casting, does it all work? I find Karen a little grating, I won't lie. I don't know whether it's the character or the performance. She gets on my nerves a bit. She did less in this watch than the first time round, I have to say.
I think she gets a little bit more of that. As she becomes stronger as a character in terms of, you know, her inner strength, I think that comes out a little bit more. And I think I didn't really find a grating at this point, except for this desperate need to have this kind of family unit, and when they kept going off in all directions, like it's trying to bring Matt and Foggy together.
She's very earnest, way,
but yeah. I quite like, I think she kind of, she was the, because I think it was very clever to have her as the first case, the first victim, you know, as a throughway into Fisk's world, as well, and how they get involved. Because I think if she'd just been the secretary, then I think that wouldn't have worked as well. I think because they introduce her into that world, I think she's a very, very human character. They're all human characters, but I think it's a very kind of human, but human believable performance in her. I think she does a good job as well. And I'd only seen Deborah Ann Woll briefly. I think she was in True Blood, I think.
Yeah,
I don't really remember much sense, in that, but no, I thought she was good, and she continued. She obviously continues with the Punisher, doesn't she, as well, in season two and into the Punisher series. So there's more stuff to come with her as well, and I don't think she's the most exciting character, but I think she's a very human character there. You know, I think that kind of works. So She's fine. I agree. She's not the strongest, but she's fine. I think she works because of the way they introduced her character into the show.
Yeah, I think you might be right, actually. In fact, I'm pretty sure I remember liking her more when she was with Frank Castle later on, much more. I think I like that stuff a bit more. But, you know, I think that in this, I think you're right. I think actually she does perform an important function because you've got obviously Matt, who is quite distant from her and Foggy for a lot of the season, isn't he? Because he's keeping all these secrets from both of them at the start, and then eventually Karen doesn't end up finding out, does she, by the end of this season? She doesn't know he's Daredevil yet. No. Foggy does, obviously. So he has to be, by default, a little bit distant from them both. But he's that sort of quite brooding character. Then you've got Foggy, who is essentially the comic relief. But I think what I like about him, and I do remember one of the things I disliked about season two was that he becomes a bit of a bellend during that season, Foggy. And he just becomes annoying. He just becomes really antagonistic. Whereas here, I think he has that, when he finds out, he's justifiably upset. And I think he goes, there is more complexity to him than just a comic foil than he is at the very beginning of the season. And that's well developed and well played, I think. You start to see more shades with him.
Yeah, and again, his relationship with Karen as well. I think, arguably, the Foggy Karen relationship is stronger than the Matt Karen. I think she's a little bit infatuated with Matt, I think. I think they do become a romantic couple later on in the show, I vaguely remember, but I guess I buy her connection to Foggy more than Matt because Matt is so distant in the show. So I guess maybe that's a fading a little bit there with some of the characters. But no, I really like the scenes with Foggy and Karen just feel very real. And they're the kind of, you know, we watch all big Alias fans. They're the Will and Fancy to Matt's character. You know, it's like they're the human characters that he kind of leaves behind to become Daredevil. Because you become the Man in Black, and I like you going to get their world too. So, no, I think, and yeah, he does humor very well without feeling like he doesn't have one-liners, which can be a very great kind of direct approach to being the comic character on a show. And I think he's much more nuanced than that. So I love his humor, but his humor feels real. I think again,
yeah, it does. Yeah, I'd say it does, and I think he bounces well off Charlie Cox's deadpan.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, not straight man, because there's a little twinkle in Charlie Cox's performance that I like. You know, there's a little bit of a glint in the eye that he knows, you know, he's a bit cheeky at points. I like that about
him.
I like that about the actor. And I think he brings a little more humanity to Matt and eventually Daredevil as a result, you know. And I like that about him. And I think they do work well as a trio, I think, when they're together.
There always wasn't enough of it. The two things that I can't really imagine, it wasn't enough of them. Maybe for Karen to be fighting for them as a unit, there wasn't enough established of that. You know, I would have liked to be... I think there's only one courtroom scene in the entire season, and I would have liked more of that because I like that it can kind of almost be a courtroom drama. I like courtroom dramas are kind of one of my things. I like those. I can watch them all the time, and I kind of like that there's a bit of that, and I wish it was, obviously you get it with Punisher in season two, but that's probably one of the better things of season two, but you know, I would like more of that. So I guess it's the only thing is they don't really, maybe I don't know, because where would you fit it in, but maybe a couple more court cases and a bit more of them working together. I'm not going to say a montage, it's not that kind of show, but just a kind of a little bit more established in the day-to-day workings of Nelson and Murdoch, which you don't actually get much of, do you, in the course of the season.
No, and you're right actually about the court stuff, because some of the Bendis stuff that I mentioned in the comics, there's certain issues of that which are, there's a lot of court drama in some of it, and it's great. You know, when Matt is up there defending clients or prosecuting people, it's riveting stuff actually, and it would be great to see. It would have been great to see a bit more of that, but there is a lot to do. There is a lot to put in here because you've got to establish a lot in this season. You've got to get to grips and understand why Matt is doing what he's doing ultimately, and that's difficult to do when he's on his own for a lot of it, and he needs those characters ultimately to. And that's why Claire is so crucial, I think, as a character, because she allows us to understand a little bit more of his psychology behind what he's doing, and then later on Foggy aids with that as well towards the end of the season. But you need that for him. And the Vicar in many ways does the same. Yes. Even though he doesn't know he's Daredevil, he does
I think
understand.
He does. They play it in a way, you know, Lantern, Peter McGrobby. Yeah, I really like that relationship with Matt. And I think, particularly to on the discussions towards the end, you know, do you kill a man and so on, I kind of think he has an idea of who he is.
Probably. probably you're probably right, actually, yeah. And there's that relationship with them, which is really good. But I think that's the key with this casting, that they do work well because they perform these different functions. Mm. Structurally, you mentioned earlier a little bit about the flashbacks. What do you think about those? Those sort of the extended sort of flashback episodes. You know, you've got ones early on where you see Mac go blind, you see what happens with his dad. You've got what I think is a terrific one with Fisk, where you see him as the victim of an abusive father, domestic, who he murders out of, in a fit of pique. I think I really like those flashbacks. I think there's some really I think they're structured in many ways. I think there's an obvious link to something like Lost, which kind of set the template for a lot of this stuff. In like you say, the Arrowverse as well, does a lot with this. And I think there's a bit of that in here. I think they work well to illuminate both the character journeys and maybe things that are going on in specific episodes in this season.
Oh, I agree. I don't think it's actually that much of it either. I think the stuff with the dad and him getting blind, they're scattered for the first two or three episodes, but they're little snippets. I think enough of that story with his dad and what happened to his dad. I think it's Stick when you get Sticks introduced and... you get the essentially he's training as a kid, which is brutal, that's almost like a little bit of an odd episode, that one, because I like the episode, but it's almost like let's take you out and set up future things and then come back to the main storyline.
Is this the Stick one?
Yeah,
because it is, isn't it? It's setting up a lot of what happens in both season two of Daredevil and then Iron Fist, actually, in many ways. So and Defenders, I guess.
Definitely,
so.
Yeah. It's almost like it's set up that they which is kind of fine away because Stick is a bigger part of season two. Obviously, the relationship with Elektra as well. And obviously, the Iron Fist and then Defenders. Yeah, it's almost like because they knew that's where they're going to head, I guess it kind of works. It works in a contextual sense across the entire Defenders universe. In the course of the season, it's one episode that there's enough of it. There's human trafficking and this kind of weird child weapon. There is some mysticism in there. You get it with Madame Gao later on as well, but... I guess if it's one episode that feels a little bit out of place, I would say it's that point. It's interesting. It's exactly the midpoint of the season as well. So they focus on that. Because it's to do with Mac's backstory, I think it works. Because I think you get a sense of, you need to understand not just how he gets super sense, but, where he got the mentality. That's not the extent of his training, certainly, but you get the sense where he starts. I think that works quite well. So it gives a little bit more context to him. And then Fisk flashback, I love the character Fisk so much and this version of Fisk. And when you get that kind of background, just horrible it is, this, building towards... I mean, they tease the bloody child in the mirror, don't they, before you get to the episode. So you're like, ooh, what's going to happen? And then you show a bit more of that and it gives more context. And I think the biggest thing about Daredevil that I say I wasn't expecting, as well as the relationship with Vanessa, is that you feel sorry for Fisk.
Oh, yeah.
So much of the time. And, he's this poor child who watched, had an abusive father and who snapped and beat him to death with a hammer and then was made to cut him up with his mother. It's like his mother's act. It's like, it's horrific. It's Dexter level of horrific. But because Fisk is, I said it before, Fisk is a child. Fisk is someone who hasn't really matured. He's built like a brick shit house. He is so powerful. But he's like a bear. He can go from terrifying and rip your head off to cuddly almost. And you get moments in this when he has tantrums like a child. He has tantrums like a child, when he gets upset. When Wesley's killed, he goes, "My friend's dead." And you go, "Oh, I feel sorry for you." Even though Fisk is horrible and Wesley was horrible. But it's like, that's one of the biggest successes of the show is when you get that context and you get a sense of why he's like he is, it doesn't excuse what he does, of course. But it's like that pattern of violence. You get it in abuse victims who then quite often, unfortunately, people who inflict abuse on others have actually grown up or experienced it themselves. It's a real tragedy that, cycles continue. And you kind of get that in a sense that in one sense he's trying to step away from his dad, but he wears his dad's cufflinks every day as a reminder. And it's this kind of conflict within him. You know, he can't quite escape the shadow of the father, and, you know, that feeds into him as well. And which is fascinating TV. And yeah, great. And that's why I think, you know, that episode is one of my favourites, the flashback with Fisk, because of it adds more depth and context to it as well.
Yeah, it's really layered stuff. I do think a lot of it, like I said earlier, comes down to the performance. I think it's Vincent D'Onofrio and what he's able to do with that. But it's also in the writing, the nuances, like how when he first goes to the art place and he meets Vanessa, he's looking at that picture of white space and white, white, you know, and there's but we understand later on that he's looking at that because that's what he looked at after he killed his dad. He looked at a white wall and it calmed him. You know, it made it, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant little tethers of characterization that factor into plot, I think. And then at the very end of the season, when he's in the cell and he's looking at a white wall because it's what calms him down. It's fantastic. It's so clever. It's so cleverly thought out. And I think that's terrific. Well, you mentioned the Fisk episode, which is called Shadows in the Glass, being a favourite. So why don't we talk about some of the best episodes then of the season? I've picked out my three favourites. I don't know if you've done three favourites as well, Baz. But
I was trying to think about it because it's so serialised. It's hard to kind of think about what are your favourites, because in some ways there's great stuff in all of them. If I call it an early one, I think it's Cut Man for that hallway sequence.
Yes.
I mean, they do it brilliantly. I mean, they do these long tracking shots. And I know you haven't seen them in season three. I've seen some of season three, and there's basically an 11-minute tracking shot sequence, which is just blow.
I've heard about this. Yeah, but the one in Cut Man's very good. Yeah.
But Cut Man's so great for two reasons. It's that one tracking. I love tracking shots. It's kind of, you know, that gets me going in terms of movies. You know, that's why the opening of Spectre is one of my favourite Bond film openings. You know, that's why I love the car chase sequence in Hawkeye episode 3, because, you know, I love these. And
Kick-Ass. You must have loved Kick-Ass.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. First Kick-Ass. And, you know, I love a good tracking shot. That you know, you want to make me like a film, you put a decent tracking shot in it. It'll work.
Yeah.
it's so great for two reasons. One, because the way it's done and the way it's choreographed is so masterfully done. But also because I'm not sure I ever really kind of got a sense of it properly in a superhero thing before. Because he is not super powered, isn't a super strength, just how exhausting the fight is. You feel every moment of Matt's exhaustion as he's fighting these bad guys. And it's brutal to watch. And you feel exhausted watching it because you see just the pressure he's put under. And the moment he has to kind of pause and breathe and stagger around and find the energy and get back into the fight again. It's not just the fighting. It's those moments in between each punch and each kick when he's trying to catch his breath. That just phenomenal piece of performance there.
Yeah. I completely see that. Cut Man is a very good episode. Yeah, absolutely. I really love Speak of the Devil. I thought that was a great episode. That's number 9. And that's the episode where it's just before Foggy finds out that he's Daredevil. So it's building a lot of things up, but it's got that great cut between the fight that he has with Nobu, the ninja, the hand ninja, where he's getting the absolute shit kicked out of him, Matt, at this point. Like, he's barely, you wonder how he's going to get out of it alive.
Well, that's the reason he gets a suit, isn't he? Because he can't keep doing as he's doing.
Exactly, yeah. And it's soon after that, he goes to Potter and he gets the suit made, which is Fisk's guy. There's a lovely irony in that as well, that he gets the suit made by the guy that Fisk is blackmailing, which is great. But yeah, it's such a great episode for building a lot of things up. And it's got this great bookending fight with Nobu that ends with the first confrontation between Matt and Fisk as well. And at that point, Fisk is, you really see the evil in the character. You know, he literally just lets Nobu burn to death. And, you know, and you think at that point, how is Matt possibly going to beat this guy? Because he's bleeding almost to death and he has to escape with his life just at the end. And I just think that is a tremendous episode for all the things it's building up. And it's one of those that it's at a crucial point in the season, because it's just before the final act, essentially, of the season. But it really does, in some ways, it's Fisk at his most powerful.
Yeah,
because he's
absolutely.
He's kind of reached that point where he thinks he's gonna beat him. You know, he does. You know, and I love that. I think that's a great episode.
I agree. I think that's a fantastic episode. I'd say the one before it, Shadow in the Glass, with the Fisk backstory, is great. Possibly also episode 4, In the Blood, because
Yes, yeah, Vanessa, that's one of mine.
And Fizzo, because you get, you expect him to be this brutal, nasty guy who, you know, and he absolutely can be. But you get loaded his false insecurity because you see his relationship with Vanessa and that connection, and they go on the date, and it's just lovely. And you see the social awkwardness in him, that child in him. He doesn't really know how to react. And, you know, it's a lovely connection between them. And I think, you know, the connection between Don Frio and... Ayelet Zura, it's one of them. I mean, she's fantastic as well, because she is naturally what she brings the gun to the date, because it might be that, or it might be a later one. It might be the later one actually, but you know, she knows who he is and she's afraid of him. And actually, it's when she finds out about his past and his dad, that's when she goes, you know, I'm with you. I understand you, you know, and that kind of strength in the relationship builds. But it is wonderful stuff. You're thinking your first proper introduction, because he's only teased at the end of the previous episode, is going to be this terrifying bad guy. And instead you find this guy who finds his connection with a woman and goes on this awkward dinner date. And it's lovely. And you kind of, you really get invested. And then he gets embarrassed by the Russians. And then snaps, and it's what makes the end so shocking is the violence of it, because it's a scary scene when he gets the Russian and he basically beats him and decapitates him with a car door. You've seen the violence, particularly in episode 2 with the hallway fight, but you didn't think it was going to go this far, and it goes that far. And Ben watched, went, did his brain just fall? I think it did. You know, it's nasty, brutal stuff that you're never going to see.
Yeah.
But you get the two sides to Fisk. You get the romantic, awkward, shy side of Fisk, and then you get the brutal monster that comes out when he lashes out. And he's embarrassed, and it's because he was embarrassed, and he didn't want to be embarrassed, and that's why he snaps. And it's not betrayal. It's not, you know, like when with Owsley later on, right towards the end of the season, when I think that might be the final episode, when he eventually kills him for the betrayal. You know, it's, you know, they're understandable. This is because he was embarrassed, and you see that he's frightening, but also he doesn't have the social skills and understanding. You know, there is something that's broken inside him, going back, which you see with his childhood. That means he doesn't necessarily isn't able to control his emotions, and you see that in the most shocking way possible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with Leland, the difference with Leland later on is that I was kind of cheering when Fisk threw down the shaft. Because he was a bastard like that. And I love Bob Gunton. He's such a great actor. He built a career on playing shits. And he plays shits really well. And Leland is a shit throughout. Bear in mind, he actually tries to kill Fisk. He tries to get Fisk back on track by killing Vanessa, trying to kill Vanessa with poison. And this is all his idea, essentially, him and Madame Gao. And so that's how much of a shit he is, right? So I was well happy when he threw him down the shaft. I was like, yes, Fisk!
He kind of got off lightly, I thought.
Yeah, I thought he'd just squash his head, you know, and do like a Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness and just squeeze his head.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is different in that I think this is Wilson Fisk's Tony Soprano moment for me in The Blood. In that, I think this portrayal of Fisk is heavily inspired by James Gandolfini in The Sopranos, and I think this moment reminded me a lot of College in season 1 of The Sopranos, which is the first time you see Tony Soprano kill a man with his bare hands. He just strangles a man to death, and it's shocking because you know he's a crime boss, yes you know he's dodgy, yes you know he's a criminal, but you don't know he's a cold-blooded murderer until that point, about 6 episodes in. And that's the point where you go, if I've had any sympathy for this man, technically it should be gone, because he's a cold-blooded killer, basically. And that's the same thing with Fisk, in that it's slightly done slightly differently, obviously, but it's that juxtaposition of a sensitive man who does love a woman, who's had a fucked up childhood that has heavily caused him to be who he is, but equally he's just also a psychopath. And I think that's the great balance. And again, it comes down to the performances. In The Sopranos, the reason Tony Soprano is such a fantastic character is James Gandolfini and the way he plays him. And he takes it off the page. And it's the same with D'Onofrio. You know, I think in lesser hands, Fisk would not have been as nuanced.
And
I think
absolutely not.
We have
and
to give
D'Onofrio,
him.
I'd seen him in stuff before, but I thought he was a decent actor. I'd never seen anything he had done and gone, wow. And then he came along, and this is his performance. This is the one where you go, wow, this is phenomenal acting.
Yeah, he does steal the show. As good as everyone else is, he steals the show completely.
Absolutely. Which kind of makes that, you know, and that final, that you know, the final episode, and it's a great final episode when you finally get the showdown between Daredevil, you know, where Matt in the suit versus Fisk.
It's so absolutely
earned. And there's a little bit going, but you almost feel sorry that he has to take Fisk down because you just want Fisk and Vanessa to run off and live happily ever after. And yet, and you feel horrible because actually he's this brutal monster, and it's just that conflict in there. It's so good, you know. It's a triumphant takedown of Fisk, but it's not quite as clean cut as yes, the bad guy's been defeated, and that's what makes it so interesting. You almost become complicit in it because you're kind of invested in the Fisk Vanessa relationship. That the fact that they get separated at the end is kind of heartbreaking in a way.
Yeah. No, it is, and it's very well earned in terms of making us feel something about that relationship by the end. Even though justice has been served, he's where he should be, you know. He's done some terrible things. On the one hand, yeah, you're not sad Daredevil's lost by any stretch of the imagination. Or won, I should say, by any stretch of the imagination. But, yeah, there is some sympathy. And also, it leaves the door open. You know, I think this season does a good job of leaving doors open for the future. You know, it positions Fisk in that classic comic book, you know, trope of being in jail. He'll come back. And obviously we do see him a little bit in season two, but it's, you know, he's fairly in the background there. And there's lots of other little doors that are open, like the mystery of Madame Gao, which then comes into Iron Fist and Dead Defenders, Stick again, you know, possibilities for certain characters. And it's very good. That final episode was one of my three, as well as the other In the Blood and Speak of the Devil, because it does build everything up to a cathartic register, and it feels very earned, and you get the shot so you see him in the suit, and it's great. You know, if you'd started off and you'd done that much earlier, you wouldn't nearly have the same sense of satisfaction in seeing him become Daredevil. And then, as you say, season two is Daredevil, you know, it's him in the suit. And that's why, you know, the best stuff in season two is all the stuff with the Punisher and him, because it is him facing the reflection of himself as a vigilante with somebody who is even way more extreme than him, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and that's what the best stuff in that season is. So, yeah, it's a great season of TV. It's really well told. It's well performed. It builds off the universe that it sort of stemmed off from in a really good way. It fleshes out lots of really great incidental characters. People like Ben Urich as well, who's a really good character in the comics. He's in lots of comics. It's almost a shame he dies in this, because he's a really great character in the comics, and he pops up in lots of different things, whether it's Daredevil, Spider-Man, She-Hulk. He's quite an important character to the MCU. So it's a kind of a and he, in the comics, he works for like J. Jonah Jameson and all these people. So it's kind of a shame that Vondi Curtis Hall isn't going to be able to come back for this if it stays canon, because he's a great character and he's really good in this.
Oh, absolutely. No, Vondi Curtis Hall is a great, it's an interesting relationship with Karen as well. I think maybe one of the reasons you find Karen a little bit frustrating, because she's responsible for his death. And she pushes too far. Yeah. She pushes too far.
She does.
And I like that the episode ends, you know, Matt senses it in that kind of one of the final scene between him and Karen, that, you know, she's not got over this. And kind of rightly so. She's got a lot of shit to deal with as a result of what happened, you know, that when she, you know, accidentally kills Wesley. And then, you know, and she's responsible for Ben's death, you know, not directly. Obviously, that's a horrible moment when you know it's coming. And then
it's
when
a great scene, though,
and
isn't it?
When Fisk turns up in there, and you know that's it. Ben is dead,
and he's like I've not come here to warn you. I've come here to kill you. And then it's so good.
It's his mum. Exactly, it's his mum.
They basically inadvertently threaten
his mum. It's like, I don't want mum to get hurt, so I'm going to kill
you.
And that's
the
motivation. It's great. It's that childlike stuff again, you know. It's basic child motivations in a way. And
it's
so
definitely
great to watch.
Yeah, child psychology influencing the adult. It's fascinating. Yeah, absolutely. So there's lots of nuance, lots of great character work. It's just a really, really great season. It's really good.
Absolutely.
might be the best season of the show. We'll see. I mean, we haven't seen all of it yet. It's definitely, I would say it's definitely better than season two from what I remember.
Yeah, I think so.
And season three, the jury's open for both of us because we've not yet seen it.
Yeah, I've seen half of it. And while I've seen half of the season, I think season one is still stronger. I think, but it's, you know, it's a great season of TV. And you're right, I don't think, as much as I've really enjoyed everything that Marvel have put out in 2021 on Disney Plus, I think nothing has come close to the first season of Daredevil.
No. Not. There's very little. I'm looking forward to Jessica Jones season one and see if it tops it. But this was terrific. Really great to revisit again. And hopefully, everyone, you've enjoyed us talking about it. And on starting this, we're going to try and do one a month of these seasons for the Netflix shows. And who knows, we might start to see more connections between these and the MCU. And so it might be quite timely to revisit these characters and these worlds again. So, Baz, it's been great. I think...
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. I think you and I, we might well be back for season three of Daredevil together.
I think so, yeah.
I think that's the working plan. Maybe not season two, but season three. So it'd be great to circle back and talk to you then. But until we do, and you pop up on Podcast 616 again, whenever that is, point people towards what else you're up to, because you're doing other podcasts on We Made This and various and sundry. So yeah, give us some directions.
Yeah, so on We Made This, you can find me as the co-host of the TARDIS Crew, a .2 podcast to do with my son Ben. So we have a twice monthly podcast there where we talk all things Doctor Who. That's been going since last year. Along with Tony, I'm one of the main hosts of Authorised Podcast Only, an Alias podcast, and we're working through season one now. I think I'm on most of the episodes coming up as well, so hearing me talk about Alias a lot in the first half of 2022. And I've got a few more projects I'm working on with Luke, which one of the other podcasters, which I'm hoping to announce soon. And yeah, you'll find me on various podcasts. I've just done a couple of episodes of scheduled programming. I think I've got one coming up on Dexter, New Blood as well. So you'll find me on We Made This at various podcasts.
Yeah, you're everywhere. You've caught the bug now for sure. So 2022 is the year of Baz. So keep an eye on it. It's going to be great. And you can find me at AJ Black Writer, mainly on Twitter and on Instagram and on Facebook. I'm knocking about on there as well. And my website, ajblackwriter.com, where you'll see bits of my writing and the books that I've written and the ones that I'm supposed to be writing and keep procrastinating on, because that's what we do as writers. You know these full well, Baz, as a writer yourself.
Absolutely, yeah. I should probably say I've also written for the Left for Stuart books, for Candy Jar books as well. So I've got a novel that came out a couple of years ago, Forward to the Past, and I've got some more projects coming up, including a short story in the Unit Files as well, which is basically a Brigadier and Benton story from the 1970s. So that's coming out of Candy Jar Books soon.
That's exciting. If we ever get time to write, now we podcast, but you know, this is the balance we have to make. But check me out on there on those if you want to find a bit more of what I'm doing. And I'm obviously on the We Made This podcast network, so thanks for joining us for another episode. Please subscribe to Podcast 616 and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That will really help us bump up. There's lots of other Marvel podcasts out there, so the more you review, the 5-star review, the better, because we'll get even more known. And if you do want to help our network more broadly and all the shows we've mentioned and more, please consider supporting us on Patreon if you go to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. But Daredevil is not all we're talking about, so we'll give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in just a minute. But we'll see you next time for season one of Jessica Jones in this little pocket corner, and some Daredevil tat as well. So that'll be quite fun. But until then, stay safe and well, and we'll see you next time on Podcast 616.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Academy Watch.
I saw West Side Story actually the other day, and I didn't really connect with it. So, you know, some I'll like and some I won't, but generally I like the idea of a musical. Disney films, the animated Disney films, tend to enjoy them.
Of course. Are you a La La Land person? Because I was definitely a La La pet.
I hate La La Land. I just could not stand it.
Wow. We can't be friends anymore. I'm just going to, hang on, how do I turn this thing off?
Yeah. I've lost a lot of friends over this opinion, but I hate it.
Garfield is the best Spider-Man and La La Land is shit. Like, what?
I just like to be controversial.
We dig music.
But yeah, just missed out on my list this year. There was the Garbage record was great, so I got head off that.
Yeah, I was surprised that didn't end up on the main.
It was close.
I was surprised to not see it.
Wet Leg, who have released two songs so far. There's another one apparently coming out
terrible
later
band
this week.
Name.
Yeah, I can't get behind it. That's what our old history teacher was called, Mr. Wet Leg. It's actually Westlake, but like, apparently he pissed himself once.
Amazing. Yeah, it's a fucking terrible band name, but they're great.
It's like if Wet Leg toured with pissed jeans. Can you imagine?
Right in the childhood.
When I was younger, Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man looks way older than I was as a kid.
He looks older than you do now.
Way older than I am. Yeah, and that was a constant thing in the cartoons as well. Like in the cartoons, like the 90s one, he looked older. Mm. And that was the cartoon I watched when I was younger, was the 90s one. And we would have done that for this show. But as soon as Disney Plus came out, I binge-watched it all. And then I encouraged you to watch it.
Yeah, and I've watched
it
as well.
And then we started the podcast.
And we were like, oh, shit, we should have saved it.
That should have been it. And then there was another one with Neil Patrick Harris in, which I probably did.
What, as in Doogie Howser MD?
Yeah, and, you know...
Ooh, I'm going to put that on my list.
A Doogie Howser.
Doogie Howser MD.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.